Following the First World War, Germany, having never found its feet economically throughout the conflict, now found itself crumbling under the further weight of heavy reparations. Many of those that had survived the fighting found themselves in a desperate state, carrying out all sorts of underground, legally dubious, or just straight up illegal activities in order just to get by. There were some that thrived in the lawless environment, profiteering from others' misfortune. And then there were others, a very select few, who not only thrived, but positively excelled at breaking the law. And amongst those, there were one or two who did so in some very dark ways. Friedrich Hamann was one such individual. Trading used clothing by day, he carried out a series of brutal murders that would earn him the monikers of the Butcher of Hanover, the Wolfman, and the Vampire of Hanover. Perhaps even more frightening than his nicknames was the attitude of the man himself, who once told a shocked audience, "Oh, believe me, I'm not ill. It's only that I occasionally have funny turns." This is Dark Histories, where the facts are worse than fiction. Hello and welcome to Dark Histories, Season 8, Episode 9. I literally just looked that up and I've almost forgotten already. I think it's Episode 9. Pretty sure it's Episode 9. It's good to be back. Just a quick shout out. Thank you for all the messages from people sending condolences about the cat. It's very kind and thoughtful. It's very nice. Thank you very much for all those messages. We're back with a bang today. I do want to give a quick just sort of content warning, I guess, for this episode. I don't normally do these. I generally tend to think, you know, it's a podcast called Dark Histories. We're all adults. We know what we're getting into. But with this one, with the subject matter, there is a quote later on in the episode that is particularly difficult, probably, if you're a bit squeamish with gore. I would probably skip that quote. but I will give you a heads up just before it as well. So it shouldn't catch anyone out. But otherwise, say the content warning just in general. This one's we're getting into the gutters with this one. It's pretty deep down and dark. So back with a bang. Let's go. This episode's called Fritz Hamann, the Vampire of Hanover. Living as a citizen in post-First World War Germany was not a particularly easy thing to do, even in a modern, industrialised urban environment. With the country being poorly equipped economically to survive the war, the Allies' strict blockades on goods and food made it increasingly difficult to survive without resorting to fairly extreme measures. Prior to the war, Germany had relied upon imports for almost a third of their food and farming supplies. With the vast majority of men fighting on the front, by the end of the war, the country's food production had almost halved, despite women and war prisoners filling in for part of the shortfall. As a knock-on effect, animals and livestock suffered, heavily impacting the supply of meat and dairy. As the government continued to restrict food by enacting heavy rationing and price caps, food riots followed, as farmers began selling their produce to the highest bidder, and frustration and desperation kicked in throughout the population, especially in urban areas. Inequality thrived as those from rural farming districts or those with connections to farmers out of town began buying or stealing food that they would then sell in the burgeoning black markets that had become a staple of daily life in the cities. The illegal markets were such an open problem that detectives and informers were tasked with spending a huge amount of their time scouring the train stations, seeking out the smugglers as they returned from food runs. By the end of the war, malnutrition, starvation, and tuberculosis rates had all skyrocketed, with over 750,000 civilian deaths recorded as a consequence of food shortages. Peacetime brought scant relief. With a tanking economy, hyperinflation decimated the German mark, compounding the already dire situation and leading to the continuation of the black markets for years following the war. Far from solving everyone's problems, the declaration of the German Republic in November of 1918 did little for the general population, who had almost no confidence in the unstable coalition that had formed the government. In Hanover, in central northern Germany, 180 miles west of Berlin, people felt the sting of goods and food shortages, along with an increasingly worthless currency, as much as any other city in the country. With a population of just under 500,000, it had exploded in size towards the end of the 19th century, as industrialisation had hit the region hard. A relatively small city, surrounded by thousands of acres of woodland, Hanover had grown and expanded with the introduction of coal mining to the area, with surrounding villages transforming into factory hubs. Like other urban areas in Germany, the black markets in Hanover had thrived throughout the war, as the railway station became a strange mix of travel hub, smuggling centre and homeless shelter. Black markets nearby sold an assortment of nefarious goods, including second-hand clothing, dairy, bread and meat from rabbits, goats, dogs and cats, many of which had been stolen or died from disease. By the spring of 1924, 6 years after the end of the war, things had barely improved. The German mark was at an all-time low, with inflation having risen to an astronomical scale. And then, when things for the majority of the German people looked as if they couldn't get any worse, the city of Hanover was thrown into a state of excitement, shock and panic, when a considerable number of human bones were discovered, seemingly discarded into the river, leading to a national scandal. Things went from bad to strange in Hanover on the 17th of May 1924, when a group of three children playing by the bank of the river, south of the Herrenhausen Gardens, found a human skull, and then 12 days later, a second skull washed up along the same bank. After being examined by the police doctor, it was concluded that they had both been the skulls of young men, around the ages of 18 to 20, and whilst this sounded fairly concerning, it wasn't until 2 weeks later, when two more skulls were found, that people really began to panic. One of the skulls found in June had washed up along the river by a mill, whilst the second, which had had its scalp removed, had been found amongst the sediment on the riverbank further to the east. Once more, they were examined and determined to be of young boys, this time between the ages of 11 and 13. It wasn't until after the second pair of skulls had been found in June that the results of the examinations were made public, confirming that the skulls had been forcibly and brutally removed from their bodies using a sharp instrument. Rumours quickly began circulating as people put forward their own theories, whispered through the streets and homes, with the two most popular ideas surfacing that they were either discarded by the nearby medical institute in Göttingen or discarded by grave robbers who had been caught in the act and had tossed them into the river during their getaway. Things quickly spiralled into more of a panic, however, when another group of young boys, playing in a patch of marshland, uncovered a discarded burlap sack that had been stuffed full of bones. Following the discovery, rumours quickly switched from thoughts of unscrupulous medical students to something much darker, as people began to fear that in the largely unquestioned butchering trade, which had been operating with illegal and at times unsavoury meats, someone had been harvesting homeless young boys from the streets to sell their flesh on the black markets, which quickly led to a moral panic. The fears of a deranged murderer on the loose were not at all helped by the ever-growing list of missing persons, many of which were young boys who had run away from home in the years following the war, which by 1924 stood at over 600 names. Spurred on by these rumours, Hanoverians organised a search party a week later, on the 8th of June, the weekend of a religious holiday, in order to try and find evidence that might lead to a trace on the boogeyman that had manifested in the public mind. Hundreds of locals came out in what was the largest search in German criminal history, and when they discovered a number of human bones discarded by riverbanks and tossed into hedges, the police, fronted by Detective Superintendent Ratz, built a temporary dam across the river in the centre of town in order to search the riverbed. The results were more gruesome than most had anticipated, as piles of bones were dredged from the exposed riverbed. After they had been collected, catalogued and painfully pieced together by the court doctor, it was determined that they had discovered the remains of at least 22 people, all of which were young men aged between 15 and 20 years old. Many of the bones had evidently been in the water for some time, but there were plenty that showed signs of being recently dumped. As the rumours continued to show more and more signs of being horrifyingly realised, the officials went to work trying to track this butcher of Hanover, and before long, suspects were being rounded up as the police hauled in hundreds of deviants from around the black markets and the nearby Old Town, which had long been known as a den of vice and illegality. One suspect stood out to the police more than others, however. Fritz Harman was a local dealer in second-hand clothing, who had also been known to deal in black market meat from time to time, and whilst he was well thought of generally, with many people thinking him something of a charmer, he also had something of a reputation for sexually assaulting young boys. He was arrested on the 23rd of June, and though he denied all accusations at first, it didn't take too long before he was confessing to far more than the police or even the grisly rumours had ever imagined. Born on the 25th of October, 1879, Friedrich Heinrich Karl Hamann, better known around Hanover as Fritz, had grown up in a relatively comfortable environment, though his relationship with his parents was never truly stable, and his father, an unemployed railwayman who had been sacked following an accident that had ended up in the death of a train driver, was known around Hanover as a syphilitic old womanizer who liked to drink, despite having married into a good position and using his newfound wealth to bankroll the founding of a cigar factory. His wife, Joanna, who was 7 years his senior, had endowed upon him a healthy dowry consisting of a small fortune in cash, along with several properties, and it appeared he made the most of his position. Fritz had been their sixth child, and following his birth, Joanna spent a considerable amount of time in bed, unwell. Despite this, she doted on Fritz in a relationship that existed in stark contrast to that of his and his father's. As Fritz grew up, he showed signs of being an intelligent, competent young man, though somewhat unusually, he took pleasures in practices which at the time were seen as feminine activities, such as learning to darn clothing with his mother. At school, he proved to be a popular boy whose teachers praised his exemplary behaviour but scolded him for his below average performance. Twice he had to be pulled back to repeat years before he finally graduated at the age of 15. Following school, his father set him up with an apprenticeship with a locksmith. But not taken to the work, in April of 1895, Fritz signed up as a non-commissioned officer, where he was sent to the German-French border commune of Neuf-Brisach, an 18th century fortress town that housed over 5,000 officers. Just like in school, Fritz gained a reputation for exemplary behaviour, and he developed his skill as a talented gymnast. But 6 months after his enlistment, things began sliding downhill. In September, he was admitted into the sick bay, suffering from what was diagnosed as sudden mental disturbance, though it sounded an awful lot like anxiety. A month later, he was readmitted, this time showing signs of epilepsy, which led him to be discharged a month later upon his own request. After he returned to Hanover, he started work in his father's cigar factory, but given the pair's tempestuous relationship, the position was not to last, and by the summer of 1896, Fritz, lost and wayward, had found himself arrested after he had developed the fairly unsavoury practice of luring young boys into dark alleyways or sheltered doorways and then sexually abusing them. It was the start of what was to be a reasonably traumatic period that saw him bounce from asylum to hospital and back again, as he was diagnosed with congenital mental deficiency, and the town doctor, Dr. Schmalfus, branded him incurably deranged. If Fritz had been unenthused by the cigar factory, he positively hated the asylums and would plead with the doctors to not take him back there when he was released to the hospital for diagnosis. That October, he escaped whilst working in the gardens, but fleeing to his family home, he was rounded up 5 days later and dragged back, kicking and screaming, before being transferred to Lagenhagen on the northern outskirts of Hanover. 2 months later, on Christmas Day of 1897, he proved just how strong his fear and hatred of the asylum system had become, when he escaped a second time, this time choosing to make the 460-mile trek to the Swiss border, where he stayed with relatives in Zurich. Fritz's life in Zurich seemed to return to some level of normality, and he worked in a shipyard for a year before taking a position as an assistant pharmacist. In April of 1899, now aged 20, Fritz returned to Hanover, with the drama of his escape from the asylums 2 years previous having blown over. But things slid almost immediately south, as his father once again attempted to force him into work with his factory, whilst Fritz continued to rebel. In a last-ditch effort to settle him down, his parents arranged a marriage to a young lady named Erna from a neighbouring household, but it was never quite the matrimonial ideal that they had hoped, and 1 year and one abortion later, Fritz had once more enrolled in the military following a call-up, this time as a marksman in the rifle battalion in the village of Colmar, far to the southwest. Sadly, Fritz's mother, Johanna, passed away in 1901, which punctuated a brief period of happiness for Fritz, who had once more found military life quite fulfilling. When he returned to the battalion after his mother's funeral, his mental health caught up with him once more, and following a collapse whilst out marching in December of 1901, he was hospitalised for 4 months, until he was eventually diagnosed with mental deficiency and congenital idiocy. He spent several more months languishing on a hospital ward for patients suffering nervous diseases, before finally, in July of 1902, he was dismissed from service and labelled permanently invalided. This was a difficult diagnosis, as anyone dubbed as officially unfit to work were legally excluded from ever working again, meaning that Fritz was kicked out of the military and sent back to Hanover to do his best to survive on a military pension that was growing more and more worthless by the week. Moving in with his sister, he entered into a prolonged legal battle with his father, partially due to his father withholding his share of his mother's inheritance, and partially due to their ongoing tensions over his father's belief that Fritz's illness was all a sham to excuse him from work. It was a bitter entanglement that eventually saw Fritz arrested for threatening to beat his father to death, and his father applied to have him thrown back in an asylum. The charges were eventually dropped when Fritz's siblings refused to corroborate their father's story, but given the seriousness of his father's accusations, the police still felt it prudent to have Fritz examined by the doctor, whose report made for bleak reading, at least as far as Fritz was concerned. Although Harmon is morally inferior, of little intelligence, idle, rough, irritable, and totally egotistical, he is not mentally ill as such, and there is no official reason to have him committed to a lunatic asylum. Following the doctor's examination, Fritz was released, and somewhat amazingly, despite all their earlier grievances, he managed to secure a loan from his father in order to open a fishmonger's, which he did under his wife Erna's name, due to him being registered as full-time disabled. On the side, he began working as an insurance salesman, but when the officials found out about this, they ordered him to cease working. This would have been a blow by itself, but at the same time, Fritz's home life with Erna was going from bad to worse. Erna fell pregnant, and Fritz accused her of carrying out an affair, leading to Erna tossing him out into the street and seeking a separation. This separation by itself would not have overly concerned Fritz, who had at this point contracted gonorrhea and taken to sleeping exclusively with male prostitutes or paying young boys to spend the night with him. However, a secondary problem manifested in the fact that the fishmonger's shop and Fritz's sole source of income had been registered in Erna's name, meaning that he was now left penniless, on the streets, and with absolutely nothing. But then a little adversity had seemingly never stopped Fritz, and despite his prohibition from work, he forged his credentials and found a position as an invoice clerk at a paint factory. There, he made friends with a female cleaner who, along with her 10-year-old son, formed a trio that would routinely go out at night, skulk through the graveyards and rob the gravesites, selling any finds on the black market. At the same time, he began stealing and filtering funds from work, leading to him eventually getting a sack and winding up in front of a judge, facing charges for larceny and embezzlement. It was the beginning of what would turn out to be a long career of bouncing in and out of prison, as he took on the role of a con man, working almost compulsively to lie, cheat and swindle in any way that he could. At one point, he found himself arrested for pretending to be a government cleaner, tasked with disinfecting the rooms of the recently deceased. Instead of washing the room down, however, he would simply clean them out of any valuables. Whilst awaiting trial, he was arrested once more for attempting to steal a jar of 60 pickled eggs. Fortunately, he was just awful enough at crime to find himself arrested once again in 1913, on the eve of the First World War, earning him a 5-year sentence and a cosy cell far away from the front lines. When he was released in April of 1918, he was given his freedom just in time to see the Allied armies begin their march through the German lines and the end of the war. Fritz travelled to Berlin at first, but finding nothing to interest him there, he returned to Hanover. The fighting was over, but Germany had suffered tremendously, and with the country in economic freefall, Fritz found his calling, his years of swindling proving the perfect experience to thrive in the near wasteland. But there was more to life than black markets for Fritz, who saw an opportunity for much, much more. After he returned to Hanover, Fritz set about getting back into business. He rented a shop at No. 27 Cellerstrasse a main street running through the centre of Hanover with a small room out back, which he planned to use as a living and office space. From this base of operations, he began work in the black markets, trading illegally slaughtered meat and other small, in-demand consumables. At the same time, he began working as a police informant, a position that he manipulated to his best abilities, informing the police to those criminals that he had taken a disliking to, and at the same time, working on the side of the criminals he favoured by informing them of police activity that might keep them out of trouble with the law. His general MO was to offer a smuggler or trader a space in his shop to store their illicit goods. He would then inform the police, who would raid the shop at the drop-off time, capturing the traders red-handed. Whenever the police carried out a raid using one of Fritz's tip-offs, they would be sure to cuff him in public in order to maintain the integrity of his undercover operations. Working as a police informer gave Fritz a number of incredibly useful perks, not least the ability to operate as an illicit butcher with a degree of impunity. But he also received an official detective identification card that gave him an element of power and status, as well as the ability to travel throughout the city and enter more or less wherever he liked, whenever he liked. Using these credentials, he went about his old business of picking up homeless young boys, mostly from around the station, where he would offer them a place to stay for a price. And this was exactly how he picked up the 17-year-old Friedel Roth from the station in September of 1918. A runaway, Friedel had been a difficult young man, skipping out on school and selling his father's clothes whilst he was off fighting in the war. After falling out with his mother, he ran away on the 25th of September, leaving a note for her, telling her that he would return once she was nice again. Fritz had met him with one of his friends in a cafe by the station, and after flashing his detective ID about, he offered them small gifts before taking them out to the woods and sexually assaulting them. A month later, after hearing no word from their son, and after Roth Sr. had returned home from the war, his parents began searching for their runaway son, and after asking around at the station, they quickly found that all evidence seemed to lead them to Fritz. They told the police, who sent a plainclothes officer named Braun to his shop. But when Braun arrived, rather than Friedel Roth, he found Fritz in bed with a different 13-year-old boy, which led to his arrest for sexual assault and battery. It was a remarkably close shave for Fritz, who, despite being handed down a 9-month prison sentence, had only managed to avoid a much worse fate, thanks to the fact that Braun's had failed to carry out a search of the room, citing that he had never bothered because he had not been told to. Had he done so, he would have found the head of Friedel Roth wrapped in newspaper and stuffed behind the stove. Around this time, Fritz met Hans Granz, a young swindler 22 years his junior. Born in 1901, he had grown up amongst the books of his parents' bookbinding company in Hanover Old Town. Like Fritz, he had been held back at school, eventually graduating at the age of 16, where he began an apprenticeship as a metal worker. Again, just like Fritz, he quickly decided that that line of work wasn't to his liking, and so instead he joined the army, serving a brief stint before he was unceremoniously kicked out for a repeated lack of punctuality. Upon his return to Hanover, he ran away from home and began a career in crime, trading in illicitly obtained used clothing by day and partying through the night in the dodgy slums of the old town. Hearing that Fritz was handing out cash to take young boys home from the other young men at the station, Hans approached Fritz and sold himself for some easy money. What followed was the blossoming of a business and personal relationship that would last several years. At times, Fritz looked after Hans, referring to him as like his own child. At others, he was like a business partner, and at other times again, the two were like lovers. In order to avoid his impending 9-month prison sentence, Fritz quietly moved from his previous address, choosing to rent a low-key room from an elderly widow. It worked to throw the police off his trail for a few months, but eventually they caught up with him and tossed him in jail, where he spent the majority of 1920. During this time, Hans kept himself busy, dabbling in petty crime, for which he was eventually arrested and jailed for a month before Fritz's release. When they had both been released in the new year, they rented a room in a hotel together before securing longer-term lodgings in an inn. Throughout this time, they dressed like dapper gentlemen and told the locals that they were running a draper's shop. The whole time that they were fooling people into the belief that they were little else than two respectable businessmen, They were, in reality, scamming and stealing used clothing, either by begging in the more well-to-do areas, passing themselves off as returning war veterans in desperate need of clothing, or by simply stealing it from laundry baskets. It made them a comfortable living, which Hans liked to spend on gambling and women. It was a cosy little ruse, but the law caught up with them eventually, and both were arrested in January of 1921, and whilst Hans managed to squirm out of any punishment, Fritz spent 3 weeks in prison. With the local newspapers running notices warning people against the scammers, the two had to find a new way to make money. Unwilling to move too far from the lucrative trade of second-hand clothing, they simply cut out the middleman and took to stealing clothes directly from washing lines. That summer, they rented a room at number 8 Neustrasse in the southeast of Hanover, situated by the river. Fritz told the landlord that he was renting it primarily for business storage, but would be installing Hans there overnight as a matter of security. It was sparsely decorated, with a built-in wardrobe in the cubbyhole under the stairs and an old bed and a washstand. Freedom was short-lived once more, however, and Fritz was arrested again in August, serving a further 6 months in jail. Whilst locked up, Hans continued to live on Neustrasse, telling the landlady that his boss had gone away on business. For 6 months, Hans sublet the room out to a trio of prostitutes, whilst it became a den of drinking, noise and violence. When the landlady eventually had enough of this trouble, she kicked Hans out in February of 1922, a month before Fritz's release. When Fritz returned in March, he was forced to break into his own room, only to find it completely empty. After some back and forth with the landlady, who wanted Fritz out as well, he managed to secure the room for the foreseeable future, thanks to the local tenancy laws. Shortly after, Hans returned and the two slipped back into their old way of life, trading in used clothing, illicit meat, which Fritz said he obtained from a mysterious butcher known only as Carl, and with their room serving as something of a social hub for prostitutes and homeless young boys. It didn't take too long for strange rumours to begin circulating around the place, as people questioned where the meat was really coming from and why Fritz left late at night carrying a large wax cloth sack slung over his shoulder. Bizarrely, many people began to suspect that Fritz was trafficking young boys to Africa, where he would sell them to the Foreign Legion. In February of 1923, Fritz and Hans met a young 16-year-old pianist from Berlin named Fritz Frank, who had been homeless and sleeping at the station. Frank had originally travelled from Berlin, where he had robbed his parents in order to sell their belongings on the black market before running away to Hanover with a friend of his. Fritz set Frank's friend up with enough money to sleep in a nearby hostel whilst he took Frank home with him. For a while, Frank partied with Fritz, Hans and their prostitute friends, Eli and Dorschen, until one day Fritz sent them all out for the evening, claiming that he had a meeting with the detective superintendent about his informant work. The next morning, when Eli returned to Fritz's place in order to clean, she found the boy laying in the bed, pale as a sheet. Panicked, she asked Fritz what was wrong with him, and Fritz told her to be quiet and that the young boy simply wanted to sleep, before ordering her to return later that day. When she did return, the door was locked and Fritz yelled to her to come back later that evening. That night, Fritz finally allowed her to enter, but strangely, the room inside had been cleaned from top to bottom already. Agitated, Fritz asked her if she could smell anything bad before explaining to her that Frank had gone away to Hamburg. If all this wasn't odd enough, Frank's clothing was still lying on the bed. 2 days later, when Eli and Dorschen were cleaning the room once more, they came across Frank's cigarette holder in a drawer, and considerably worse, they found a foul-smelling bucket in the cubbyhole full of pieces of meat that had been crudely covered with a bloody apron. By now, the two women were sufficiently panicked, and so grabbing a few small cubes of the flesh, they hightailed it to the police station, where they presented it to the police detective Müller and explained their suspicions. As it happened, Müller knew Fritz very well, given that he was Fritz's contact at the police station for his position as an informant. Somewhat disbelievingly, he took the meat samples from the girls and handed them over to the police surgeon, Alex Schackwitz, who gave the meat a cursory sniff before declaring it to be a couple of lumps of pork, a quite impressive feat under normal circumstances that was made all the more spectacular given that he had had a cold at the time that had blocked his nose entirely. Just to be safe, Müller arranged for a search of Fritz's place, but nothing untoward was found, and so all suspicion was dropped. A month later, Fritz met Wilhelm Schultz at the station, a 16-year-old writer's apprentice who accompanied Fritz home one night, and then after setting off to work one day, was never seen or heard from again. That month, Fritz also went into partnership with a retired police commissioner named Ulferman, who had recently folded his own detective agency. Knowing Fritz as a good informant, he suggested that the two open their own detective agency, and it was a deal that Fritz jumped on that would further extend his credibility amongst the locals, along with his credentials that would now be at such a level that he would be able to meet, seduce, and ultimately kill with complete impunity. May turned out to be a busy month for Fritz. After first killing Roland Hutch, a 16-year-old student who had run away from home to fulfil his dream of joining the Marines, he turned his hand to Hans Sonnenfeld, a 19-year-old Hanoverian who had spent his time hanging out with other loose ends around the station, and whom Fritz slept with and then murdered. Roland Hutch's parents did contact the police to report their son missing, but the police, who saw Roland as just another down-and-out runaway, failed to follow up his parents' pleas, and the missing report was quickly lost on the desk of a disinterested officer. A month later, Fritz had bumped into the 13-year-old son of his neighbour, Ernest Ehrenberg, whose parents owned a shoemaker's shop. Ernest had fled from his mother after he had carried out a delivery for one of his father's customers and mislaid the payment on his way home. Fritz consoled Ernest and then took him home. His parents never saw him again. By now, things were heating up a little too much for Fritz, however, as he was becoming more and more aware of the rumours circulating the neighbourhood concerning the fact that a lot of young boys were seen coming and going from his room, though significantly fewer seemed to be going. After a tobacconist and his wife from the shop opposite Fritz's lodgings attempted to follow him one night whilst he had been out taking a sack of body parts out to the river, Fritz made the decision to move on to a new base of operations, moving from his room on Neue Strasse and renting a room in an old wooden-framed tavern whose landlord was an acquaintance of his. Between August and September, Fritz killed three young boys, 18-year-old Heinrich Struss, 17-year-old Paul Broniszkowski, and 17-year-old Richard Graf, all three of whom had been runaways that he had met at the train station, where he had offered them a place to stay and the promise of finding them a job, before taking them home, sexually assaulting them, and then killing them. Disposing of the bodies was always a rather difficult affair for Fritz, but there was one potential avenue he used, which allowed him to not only be a gracious and generous host, but also to earn a good income. Fritz began selling meat at half the usual price to the landlord of the tavern that he lived above, and though he assured them that it was always horse or pork, no one was ever quite sure where the meat came from, and the taste was said to be somewhat unusual. At other times, Fritz used the tavern kitchen to make sausages or mince, which he served to his guests, earning him a good reputation amongst the locals. Over the next 6 months, Fritz continued to kill at least another 17 young boys. Wilhelm Erdner was a 16-year-old locksmith's son who had run away from home, as was Hermann Wolf, both who were killed in October of 1923. 13-year-old Heinz Brinkmann, 17-year-old Adolf Hanapel, and 18-year-old Adolf Hennies were all murdered by Fritz prior to Christmas in the usual manner, all being runaways that he had whipped off the streets and then slaughtered in his room. Ernest Speaker and Heinrich Koch were both 17 years old when Fritz met and murdered them both in January of 1924. Ernest Speaker was one of the few murders that Fritz really remembered carrying out. When he woke up in bed next to the dead boy, he said that he had found him stiff and blue. "I pulled him out of bed by the hands, laid him on the floor, and cut him up." These murders were followed by 17-year-old Willy Senger and 15-year-old Hermann Speikart, both of whom were killed in February. In April, another 17-year-old runaway who had fallen foul of his parents' good humour by skipping school and lying to them had run away from home and been sleeping rough around the station before Fritz came across him. Later that month, he killed 22-year-old Hermann Bock. This case was unusual, not least because of his age, but also due to the fact that he had been known to Fritz for several years before he had killed him. The two had met in 1921 at the station. Bock was a labourer by trade, who spent most of his time hanging around wasting time in the hovels of the old town. Fritz had used him as an assistant in several of his detective cases, informing the police, whilst also having him sell some of his second-hand clothing from time to time. When Bock's neighbour approached Fritz to see if he knew of his whereabouts and to suggest that they report him missing to the police, Fritz assured them that since he was so well known to the station, he would take care of it. Of course, he did not. Despite the obvious suspicion from Bock's neighbour, it didn't seem to stop Fritz from wearing Bock's suit, which he later said he had bought from the missing man. The spring of 1924 saw Fritz murder another 7 young boys: Wilhelm Apel, Robert Witzel, Heinz Martin, Fritz Wittig, Friedrich Abeling, Friedrich Koch, and Erich de Vry. All the while Fritz was getting on with his business as usual, skulls had begun turning up in the river, and the citizens of Hanover were spiralling into a moral panic. Throughout May and June, the number of bones pulled from the riverbed or in the marshes and bushes along the banks multiplied. At the same time, the police found the pressure to close up the case ratcheting up just as quickly, as panic and fear ripped through the streets of Hanover and quickly spread to wider Germany via the press, who were posting details of the finds in the hope of prompting any witnesses or people with potential leads to come forward. The police had been questioning people throughout the old town extensively, where they found one name pop up over and over again: Fritz Hamann. As it happened, Fritz was well known to the police, not only for his work as an informant, but for his continuous trips to jail for swindling and sexual assault. As a matter of fact, they had searched his home on several occasions before, but in most cases, nothing criminal had ever been found, and in those that had wound up with an arrest, it was never for anything like murder. For all the reports of him being a con man, a thief, and a sexual predator, there were reports that he was a perfectly amiable gentleman, and there was no doubt that he had been helpful for the police in the past. Still, he rose as the number one suspect, and so the police agreed on a course of action. Seeing as how all of the officers in Hanover were well known to Fritz, they enlisted the aid of 2 young policemen from Berlin, who were to go undercover and pretend to be runaways dossing at the station. Whilst doing so, they'd keep a close eye on Fritz and hopefully find out just what rumours about him were true, if any at all. As luck would have it, none of this plan ended up being necessary, as just as the groundwork was being laid on the 22nd of June 1924, a young 15-year-old boy named Karl Fromm was arrested at the station for being a homeless runaway, travelling on stolen papers. In what was pure coincidence, Fromm had been handed to the police by Fritz himself. Only if now Fromm was at the station, he had his own story to tell. According to him, he had been approached by Fritz whilst he had been sleeping at the station, and Fritz had invited him back to his house. He had then spent several days at his home being sexually assaulted. The officer on duty at the time, aware that Fritz was a suspect in an active investigation and completely unaware of how dangerous he was thought to be, took it upon himself to march over to Fritz's home in the early hours of the morning on the 23rd of June, where he arrested Fritz and had him thrown in jail. At first, Fritz denied all the allegations against him. But eventually, as he was intentionally starved, force-fed laxatives, sleep-deprived and severely beaten for a week, he confessed to the murders of dozens of young men. The cries and chants from the baying crowds of parents of missing children who had camped outside the police cells and heavily pressured the police into acting, on threats of them carrying out their own mob justice, had probably helped matters along too. In the end, Fritz confessed to so many murders that he could not remember which of the missing boys were killed by his hands at all and which were not, nor could he remember how he carried any of them out. When asked how many he had killed, he said simply, "Maybe 30, maybe 40, I don't know. There are some you don't know about, but it's not those that you think." For many of the murders, Fritz never gave the police any specific information on how, when, or why he had killed each victim, but he did relay an incredibly disturbing general overview of how he went about disposing of a body that gave a telling insight into how systematic he had created the task. For the squeamish out there, you may want to skip ahead now. "I never intended to kill those youngsters. Some of the boys did come back several times. I then wanted to protect them from me. I knew that if I got going, something would happen, and that made me cry. I said to them, 'Don't drive me wild, because if I went wild, I would bite them and suck their necks.' Some of the boys at the Cafe Kropke liked to muffle or prevent their partner from breathing. Sometimes we scrapped for hours. It's not easy for me to get going. Lately it's happened more often. It used to worry me. Oh God, where's it going to end? I would throw myself on top of those boys. They were worn out by the antics and the debauchery. I bit through the Adam's apple. Must have throttled them at the same time. I would collapse on the dead body. I'd go and make myself some strong black coffee. I'd put the body on the floor and cover the face with the cloth so that it wouldn't be looking at me. I'd make 2 cuts in the abdomen and put the intestines in a bucket. I'd dip a towel in the blood collected in the abdominal cavity and keep doing that until it had all been soaked up. Then I'd make 3 cuts from the ribs towards the shoulders, take hold of the ribs and push until the bones around the shoulders broke. I'd then cut through that area. Now I could get the heart, lungs and kidneys and chop them up and put them in my bucket. Then I'd take the legs off, then the arms. I'd take the flesh off the bones and put it in my waxcloth bag. The rest of the flesh went under the bed or in the cubbyhole. It would take me 5 or 6 trips to take everything out and throw it down the toilet or into the river. I'd cut the penis off after I'd emptied and cleaned the chest and stomach cavities. I would cut it into lots of little pieces. I always hated doing this, but I couldn't help it. My passion was so much stronger than the horror of the cutting and chopping. I'd take the heads off last. I used a little kitchen knife to cut around the scalp and cut it up into little strips and squares. I'd put the skull face down on a straw mat and cover it with rags so that you wouldn't hear the banging so much. I'd hit it with the blunt edge of an axe until the joints of the skull split apart. The brain went into the bucket and the chopped up bones into the river opposite the castle. Or else I went to Ellenride, where it's nice and marshy, and threw the pieces on the ground and trampled over them. Whether or not it was the torture, or the fact that the evidence had been piling up against him, Fritz had finally crumbled. Though he maintained that the skulls were not victims of his, as, like he said, he smashed the skulls of his victims to pieces. During the week that he had maintained his innocence, the police had raided his home and collected hundreds of items of clothing from his room and from witnesses who had come forward admitting to having dealt with Fritz in the past. Many of the pieces were put on display and the public had been invited to come and see if any of them could be identified as having belonged to the missing boys. It turned out that many of them could, including a green school hat that had belonged to Ernest Ehrenberg and several items belonging to Heinrich Strauss, Paul Broniszewski, Hermann Wolf, Heinz Brinkmann and Adolf Hennies, several of which had been hand-stitched by their own mothers. It even turned out that when Fritz had been arrested, he'd been wearing Hermann Brock's suit. Meanwhile, throughout the questioning, mobs had continued to form in the streets of Hanover, at one point storming a home of a group of women who were rumoured to have been in league with Fritz. The police were forced to rush round and beat their way through the crowds in order to rescue the women from the lynch mob, who were intent on closing the case in their own way. On the 16th of August, Fritz was sent for a medical examination, returning 11 days later, where he was left to sit in jail and await trial, which would open on the 4th of December at the Hanover Courthouse, in front of 2 judges and 6 jury members. Hans Granz, who had been arrested several weeks after Fritz, was to be tried at the same time. Fritz had had no money for a defence lawyer, and with the job not proving to be too popular, he had been handed the services of an elderly, relatively inept legal representative who was described as a nice fellow in the pub, but powerless and slightly presumptuous. With the opening indictment read aloud to all members of the trial, plus the 80 or so audience members, all sitting below the glass ceiling of the old courthouse, Fritz was placed on charge of murdering 27 young boys, with Hans accused of 2 cases of instigating murder. The trial then kicked off in dramatic fashion, as Fritz attempted to drag his accomplice, Hans, down with him, yelling out that Hans had done more than simply instigate 2 of the murders. Granz didn't just bring the boys to me to kill. He didn't just use all sorts of tricks to get me going. He showed the boys how to do it. He took advantage of my madness, and for days on end, he would try to persuade me to kill boys whose trousers that he wanted. He killed 2. He did worse things than me. Following this shocking outburst, over 200 witnesses began their flow through the room, some with legitimate information to share to the trial, whilst others had simply decided to make up some fiction in order to be a part of the drama and excitement. These false witnesses were not the only part of the trial that bordered on farcical, as the police officials looked to close ranks in order to avoid any of the blame for having left Fritz in the wild for so long. During his incarceration and trial, he was well looked after, provided his statements concerning the police were favourable. At the same time, the medical expert, who had been called into the trial, happened to be the same man that had declared him fit and healthy way back in 1908, and who would not have been keen to have had his diagnosis deemed faulty at best, or, at worst, seen as shouldering part of the blame. The expert forensics officer called in was Schackwitz, who had sniffed the meat samples given to him whilst having a cold and had declared them as pork, and all of this aside from a raft of smaller legal inconsistencies that had plagued the whole affair, along with the sensationalist press coverage that was by now dubbing Fritz as the Hanover vampire or the werewolf. Eventually, after 15 days of drama, pressure, confusion, fantasy and absurdity, the experts handed over their reports, stating that although they believed Fritz to have had a pathological personality, there was no illness which had robbed him of his free will, and he therefore should take the full responsibility for his crimes. At 10 a.m. on 19th December 1924, Fritz received 24 death sentences, whilst Hans was handed 2 for his part in 2 of the murders. Fritz accepted them quietly, only stating that he would go to the beheading block happily, whilst Hans appealed, though it was later rejected. At 6 a.m. on the morning of April the 15th, 1925, Fritz was handed a cigar and a cup of coffee, as per his final wishes, before he was marched from his cell and had his head placed on the guillotine in the grounds of the Hanover prison. His final words were recorded as, "I am guilty, gentlemen, but, hard though it may be, I want to die as a man. I repent, but I do not fear death." The trial of Fritz Haarmann had been one of extreme drama throughout Germany, and even after the execution, just as things had begun to calm down, there was to be one final twist that threatened to turn the whole thing upside down. A Hanoverian messenger had come across a letter, seemingly tossed aside in the street, addressed to Hans Graun's father, claiming to be from Fritz, and written on the 5th of February, months before his execution. In the letter, Fritz confessed to having fabricated his accusation against Hans. "Hans Graun's cheated on me and lied to me terribly for years, but I still couldn't stay away from him because I had no one else in the world. Graun's had absolutely no idea that I killed. He never saw anything. Graun's only knew that I was perverse and went around with young people. When things were discovered about my murdering, the police forced me to tell untruths. I was afraid of being ill-treated again, so I agreed to everything and said things about Graun's that weren't true. I, Fritz Haarmann, called upon heaven as my witness that Graun's is innocent. Graun's wasn't even guilty of dealing in stolen goods. Graun's never brought anyone to me, and had Graun's known of me killing, he would have prevented it. I can't take his guilt to the grave with me and call upon my mother as witness, who is sacred to me and who is with God. Hans Graun's has been sentenced unjustly, and that's the fault of the police, and also because I wanted revenge." This letter seemed to take several liberties. Hans had been arrested several times and found guilty for dealing in stolen goods, for example. So was it simply nothing more than the pangs of conscience, or was there more to it? The police had, without question, tortured a confession from him, but had they tortured an accusation too? Whatever the meaning behind the letter, Graun's was retried in January of 1926, and whilst the outcome was the same, finding him guilty on 2 instances, his death sentence was overturned in favour of 2 12-year sentences to be served concurrently. Following his release, he was entered into the Sachsenhausen concentration camp until his liberation at the end of the Second World War, when he moved back to Hanover to see out his life, finally passing away in 1975 at the age of 74. In the end, Friedrich Haarmann readily admitted to having killed 14 of the victims he stood trial for, and was found guilty of 24 of the 27 he was accused of in total. At one point, he admitted to having killed between 50 and 70 young boys, though in reality, the true number of his victims will likely never be known. He denied ever having sold any of their flesh as meat. Throughout the trial, when he was shown photographs of his victims, he would simply shrug his shoulders, frequently claiming to not recognise them, but with a resignation in his voice, he would tell the police to charge it to him all the same. When the bone fragments were entered into court, alongside the bloody bucket and the blood-stained camp bed that had been taken from his room, he continued to deny that any of the skulls had anything to do with him. In later years, his trial would stir a degree of controversy, mainly on the treatment of mentally ill patients and of the practices of the police, who had essentially tortured a confession from Fritz, and who had been suffering from immense pressure to not only keep their own noses clean, but also to calm the Bayern mobs, who had very clearly become set on lynching Fritz themselves if the officials were to fail. Following his execution, Fritz's head was submitted for medical examination before being donated to the Göttingen Medical School, where it remained until 2014, and it was finally cremated. So that was the story of Fritz Haarmann, and I guess there's quite a lot to talk about after these short advert breaks. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? Have you had an especially busy time and starting to feel drained? Or has the isolation of winter made those social activities just feel a little bit more challenging? It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socialising for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I personally did try BetterHelp for a little while. I found it really beneficial. I like the fact that it was really flexible and convenient. I basically did it, on my own time, could pick my hours, didn't have to leave the house, which is, you know, very useful for people, especially, you know, anxiety sufferers and things like that. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, you know, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, like I said. It's designed completely to be convenient, flexible, and, you know, to suit your schedule. You fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched with a licensed therapist, and if you want to switch that therapist, you can do so at any time for no additional charge. So this spring, why not find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp? Visit betterhelp.com/darkhistories today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/darkhistories. And that link's also in the show notes if you want to check it out there. Cheers. So, yeah, the story of Fritz Haarmann, told you, back with a bang. Pretty dark. Apologies for the gore segment, Fritz's confession. But I just thought it was really important to show his thinking and his attitude towards the murders. I thought it was really an interesting example of how, like, detached and systematic he'd made, like how detached he was from the process and how systematic he'd made it, which I think goes a long way to prove how many people he had killed. But yeah, I mean, a bit about the story in general. Sources are, of course, like, really hard to find for this story. In English, they're incredibly hard to find. And old sources are a little bit tough to read, mainly due to their depiction of gay men in the 1920s. So you end up sort of you're left kind of trying to read between the lines because, you know, about how he really acted and what he was really like. Because a lot of it is, unfortunately, just grafted onto him by a bunch of what were essentially prejudiced academics, because the best source for this is written by an academic, a psychologist who was around in the time and actually spoke to Haarmann. But unfortunately, his account, although it's really thorough, it's incredibly homophobic. So you are, sort of say, left trying to work out how Fritz Haarmann actually was, sort of minus all the sort of prejudicial language. So it's quite difficult. But an interesting story. I mean, where do you start, really? I mean, so much of it was sort of horrible and toxic and problematic. His relationship with Hans Granz, for example, was just incredibly problematic. I mean, everything they did was problematic, but dug down deep into it, it seemed like Hans was at least considered himself heterosexual. But he was clearly in a sexual relationship with Fritz. But according to him, it was because he was trying to manipulate him, basically get money out of him and use him as his kind of partner in crime. Now, whether or not that's because he didn't want to admit that he was, gay or bisexual or whatever, could well have been the case, because a lot of the difficulty of finding people who Fritz had assaulted was the fact that because it was an assault by another man, people were like, ashamed of coming forward to admit that, because obviously it was a huge taboo. I mean, it's obviously, even now, it's a taboo, you know, sexual assault. A lot of people struggle with coming forward because of the shame and the guilt and all the rest of it that they feel of that at times. So you can imagine back then, when being gay was obviously a huge taboo in itself, it was like a double whammy, I guess. So whether Hans Granz is honest and he really was a heterosexual who was just in a sexual relationship with Fritz in order to manipulate him, I don't know if that's true or not, but either way, to be honest, it's incredibly problematic. And there's a lot of other things in this that are just difficult to know what was true and what was not. So, for example, Fritz's confession in general was clearly tortured out of him, obviously coerced. And I don't think in modern times, I don't think it wouldn't stand up in court. It wouldn't be accepted. There are reports back in the day, and there's a newspaper report, one particular report that I found that described him after he'd confessed as like sitting in his cell and crying and being a broken man. And they'd essentially interpreted this behavior as like him sort of guilty and being like a broken man because of his overcome by his guilt. But I frankly interpreted that as him being a broken man because he'd been tortured for a week. And you know, if that's the case, how much of his confession can you believe? What's true and what's not? Yeah, it is certainly true that he ended up basically saying, like, you know, when the police would come up to him with a name, he would say, I can't remember, but yeah, why not? Let's just, you know, stick it on the list. I may probably did kill him. Now, was that because he killed so many people that he forgot? Or was that because he was trying to intentionally blank it out? Or was it because he was just admitting to whatever the police were throwing at him because he was desperate to, you know, get out of the beatings and the torture? Now, that's not to say I don't think he was guilty. I think he absolutely was guilty of every single one of those murders. And I think he was probably guilty of a lot more that he got away with. But I just don't think the details that we know are probably that reliable. How far from the truth they are, I don't know. And the ultimate truth is that, you know, at the fundamental, at the core, we probably got it, or the police probably got it right, you know, like he did kill a lot of people, but how true said the details, I just don't know. And one part that I probably do believe him is that he said that none of the skulls none of the skulls that were dragged out of the river were his because he smashed them all to pieces. And I believe that. I think, you know, at that point, what has he got to lose to say, no, they were mine too, if they really were? And I say, judging by that quote that I gave, that, you know, the way he'd made it so systematic, I think he was incredibly efficient with his disposal of the bodies. I genuinely do believe that those skulls had nothing to do with him. But say, that doesn't mean to say I think he's innocent in any way, shape or form. I think he probably got away with a lot more than we know. But yeah, another interesting side, which is, you know, completely away from Fritz, is the police. Like, how guilty were they, or how complicit at least were they in what was going on? Because it sounds to me like everybody knew what was happening. Like, everyone had at least an idea, and the police almost certainly had an idea. But because he was useful as an informant, and the people that were going missing were essentially homeless runaways that no one really cared about, they basically just turned a blind eye to it, it seems. You know, and there is definitely elements of that in the trial. And the psychologist who wrote the account that I was saying about Theodore Lessing, his name is, he actually accuses the police basically of being corrupt and of knowing a lot more than they let on, basically. But I think they knew a lot. And I think, you know, he got away with killing for a lot of years when he perhaps shouldn't have. But, you know, you rarely hear, you know, that side of the story, because obviously the story is always focusing on the murders and the murderer. But in this case, you've got to wonder, say, like, I think Theodore Lessing puts it in a really nice way when he says something about, you know, you can't try the snake without considering the marshland that it lived in, or something like that, which I thought was pretty a pretty sort of poetic way of putting that. But yeah, basically, you know, what were the people, the locals, you know, doing? The bit about the meat is another one that's interesting. I assume probably, you know, you want to include it because it's kind of a sensationalist part of the story, isn't it? And it's, you know, it is interesting if it's true. But he never admitted to ever selling any human meat. He said he never did. He said that he never sold any of the human meat. But I don't believe that. But I don't know why he would lie about it. Again, because at this point, you know, what more did he have to lose? He might as well have been truthful. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think he probably did. I think it sounds like he definitely did. I think he definitely sold it to his landlord in the tavern below, and I think he probably made the sausages and the mince out of them as well. I suppose the last thing to really talk about was the confession letter that was found on the street, that was written by him. I think that's all complete and utter nonsense. I think it's impossible that Hans Grand didn't know what he was saying, because obviously that letter, it was a lot longer. I only quoted a part of it, but basically the letter was exonerating Hans of any guilt whatsoever, saying that he didn't even know. I think one part of the quote that I actually included said, you know, if he'd have known about the murders, he would have tried to stop them. It's complete nonsense. There's no way that Hans didn't know every last thing that was happening in that house, because he was coming and going daily. He had, you know, he was in a relationship with Fritz. He absolutely knew what was happening. He was, you know, selling all the clothes. So he without a doubt knew what was happening. But yeah, outside of that, I guess that's it. There's not too much mystery for this one. Other than, I guess, who was the murderer in the shadows that killed the people that left the skulls intact? Who knows? I guess we're never going to find that out. But an interesting story, and say definitely fits into the dark history's criteria, I think. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed the story. It was a bit of a grim one, a bit of a gruesome one. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with something a little bit more spooky. But yeah, until then, if you'd like to contact me, my email address is contact@darkhistories.com. You can also get in touch with me on all social media and have a website, darkhistories.com. You can find all the links to everything in there. Everything is also in the show notes. You can also find ways that you can support the show if you'd like to. It doesn't always have to be financial. I do have a Patreon if that's your bag and you know you have a bit of change spare. But if not, you know, there are plenty of ways that you can support. If you need to sign up to BetterHelp, then you know, they're my sponsors at the moment. Or there's, you know, just leaving a review or anything like that. Or, you know, sharing it with your friends. Whatever. There's lots of ways. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. I will be back in 2 weeks. So until then, take care. Sleep tight.